This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
Good afternoon, I'm Lisa Labas, and this is The Rundown. We still have no winner in the contest for the Democratic nominee for Illinois State Comptroller. My colleague Isabella Nieto reports State Representative Margaret Croak and State Senator Karina Villa are separated by a thin margin. Croak is ahead by just about 2 percentage points, but that didn't stop Croak last night from declaring victory at about 10 o'clock.
I'm confident that I'm going to be your Democratic nominee to be the next comptroller.
Villa released a statement shortly after saying there were still votes to be counted and she did not concede. Whoever wins that race will face Republican Brian Drew in the November general election. Illinois Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton is now the state Democratic nominee for U.S. Senate. And throughout her campaign, Stratton pushed for abolishing immigration and customs enforcement, also increasing the minimum wage and improved access to health care. She joined our In the Loop program to discuss what her nomination means for state residents.
Illinois has just been such an example of continuing to break barriers and make sure that, we bring these diverse voices and perspectives to Washington. We have a lot of history makers coming from our state, and I look forward to following in their footsteps.
Stratton will be up against Republican nominee Don Tracy in November. Should Stratton win that contest, Illinois will see its fourth Black U.S. senator. She also would become the sixth Black woman to serve in the U.S. Senate. Other news, a Chicago Public Schools teacher says her first graders are still showing signs of anxiety and depression after last fall's deportation campaign in the city. First grade teacher Maria Hevner works at Funston Elementary. It's in the Logan Square neighborhood on Chicago's west side. And she testified yesterday on Capitol Hill about how President Trump's mass deportation campaign is affecting children. Hevner said her students were distraught after federal agents threw tear gas near the school in October, and then weeks later, one of her students had a panic attack in class.
His little body froze. His eyes welled up in tears, and he began to shake. He worried that his family members would be taken because they have dark skin, even though they are citizens from Puerto Rico.
Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin convened that hearing with Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Hevner testified the school has flagged more students than usual who need behavioral health support. Sports news, Chicago Cubs right fielder Seiya Suzuki may need to begin the season on the injured list. Suzuki was playing for Team Japan in the World Baseball Classic last week when he sprained a ligament in his knee. He was sliding into second base. He's been cleared to participate in light workouts over the remainder of this week. And Cubs manager Craig Counsell says he will then determine when Suzuki can return to action.
We're going to treat it right now, kind of see how he progresses, kind of through the weekend, and then that'll kind of determine that'll determine whether an IL stint is necessary.
Opening day for the Cubs is March 26th. You're listening to The Rundown. After the Great Chicago Fire in 1871, Chicago briefly came under martial law. My colleague Justin Bull tells us what that looked like and how it came to an end for WBEZ's Curious City.
It's Curious City,
where we take your questions
about Chicago and the region
and investigate,
report,
explore
from WBEZ.
I'm Justin Bull. Back in the fall, Chicago was in the midst of Operation Midway Blitz. That operation wound down in November, but a source at the Department of Homeland Security told the Chicago Sun-Times that federal agents could return this spring.
Hey, you guys came to the school?
So far, it's unclear if there will be another surge. But immigration enforcement continues in Chicago. A question asker wanted to know if what was happening in Chicago was martial law. So we contacted some professors, first to ask, what is martial law anyway?
Martial law is hard to define.
This is Allison LaCroix, constitutional law professor at the University of Chicago.
It's not specifically defined in federal law. The basic idea is you have some sort of emergency situation and military forces take over law enforcement.
In essence, martial law is really turning off the law.
That's Paul Gowder, law professor at Northwestern University.
And saying instead of following the law, we're going to follow the ordinary rules and routines of military conflict.
So, were the recent surges of federal forces martial law?
No, we definitely haven't seen martial law in Chicago or in Minneapolis or in LA.
Because, they say, existing laws have not been suspended, and regular civilian courts can and are functioning. But what about the people who aren't getting their day in court, or who aren't getting due process?
That's abusive, but it's abusive in a way that still operates the civilian legal system. It just operates screwed up loopholes.
Historian Tad Stormer has a different take. He says while not legally martial law, ICE's actions are functionally martial law.
Looking at what martial law is and what martial law does, being able to impose military authority over a civilian jurisdiction, that's exactly what's going on.
Stormer is a professor at Johns Hopkins University. He says the question may be better posed to the people who are being targeted by ICE.
I think that they would answer it in strikingly, shatteringly different ways. That they, in fact, are not having access to the same kind of rights and protections, and even habeas corpus is being suspended for them. They will get put on a plane and sent to Louisiana overnight. That is hardly the civilian courts working as designed.
We actually have seen martial law in America during the American Revolution, during the Civil War, but also right here after the Chicago Fire in 1871.
There was a curfew implemented. You couldn't leave your neighborhood without permission. And federal soldiers were brought in to patrol the city.
This is Professor Scott W. Berg of George Mason University. He's the author of The Burning of the World, The Great Chicago Fire and the War for a City's Soul. Berg says right after the fire, Chicago businessmen convinced the mayor to declare martial law. He gave protection of the city to General Philip Sheridan, a Civil War hero, who marched in hundreds of federal troops.
And they didn't have much to do. They would walk around the burn district at night, which was, you know, burned, like to the ground mostly.
Why a big show of force if there was no chaos? Berg says to compel compliance.
Of course, their visibility is part of the point, right? Everybody needs to see these folks in all their gear.
General Sheridan created a volunteer city militia in addition to the federal troops. It was made up mostly of local students and the unemployed.
And the city militia under his control were sort of very quickly trained, and their job was essentially just to patrol their own neighborhoods. They hand them a bunch of guns and they say, "You're on duty tonight." And that leads to problems.
Late one night, 10 days after the fire, a city attorney named Thomas Grosvenor encountered a 20-year-old militia member, Theodore Treat. Treat ordered Grosvenor to halt, and when he refused, Treat shot him.
He dies several hours later, but this is a disaster for the militias and the federal control of the city because the papers now have something other than supposed chaos to report on. They have the actual shooting of a city attorney by this young kid who had been handed a rifle. You know, within a couple of days, this falls apart like a house of cards, and the federal soldiers are gone.
There are a lot of reasons why the events of 1871 and today are not comparable. But Berg says one parallel does strike him.
I'm very, very struck by, in both cases, the creation sort of a quasi-paramilitary force. And so I see the unpreparedness of some of the people doing this as a key comparison.
Whether this was legally martial law or not, Professor LaCroix says that what matters more is who is making the decisions to bring in military-level force.
It's what in constitutional law sometimes we call the who decides question. Like, what is the situation on the ground and who decides when the emergency is triggered? And so if all the power is in the hands of the president, that is what the founders thought was a recipe for tyranny and despotism. So this mixing of the military and the civil authorities is antithetical to our whole system of government.
The founders wanted federalism, where power is shared between the central and regional governments. And that is legally the system that we have. For Curious City, I'm Justin Bull.
You can get a deeper exploration of martial law in the aftermath of the Chicago fire. Listen to the Curious City podcast over at wbez.org/curiouscity or wherever you listen to podcasts. Weather, a sunny day and a high in the mid-40s, and then tonight cloudy, some showers, a low in the mid-30s, and Thursday partly sunny, milder, high again in the mid-40s. You can find the latest news whenever you want at wbez.org or on your radio at 91.5 FM. I'm Lisa Labus. Thank you for listening.